How do you know about Julian LePond? Claude said. Roy told me he mounted all those fish and animals at the store. Huh, said Claude, lighting his pipe. I'm surprised he even mentioned him. But he did not say why he was surprised. Well, he sure is a good taxidermist, but I got the impression that Roy doesn't think much of him as a person. No, he doesn't, said Claude, and left it at that. They had been out on the river about 2.5 hours when they returned to the boathouse. Oswald was exhausted, and as he got out of the boat, his legs were shaky. He needed a nap. All that fresh air was too much for one day. He asked Claude what he did after he got off from work every day. Claude's eyes lit up. Ah, then I go fishing. Chapter 6. Dinner at 8. Oswald had been unable to avoid running into Frances Cleverdon, since she lived right next door, and finally agreed to have dinner at her house the next week. After all, he could not hurt her feelings. She had been responsible for his coming to Lost River in the first place. Frances' house was a neat blue bungalow. It was very nice inside as well, with a completely pink kitchen, pink stove, icebox, and sink, right down to the pink and white tiles on the floor. Frances showed him her prize gravy boat collection, and Mildred, whose hair, to Frances's dismay, was now the color of root beer, remarked, I'll never understand why anybody in their right mind would collect gravy boats. Although Oswald had not wanted to go that night, the food was delicious, especially the macaroni and cheese, and after dinner they played a good game of gin rummy. However, much to her sister's disappointment, Mildred did nothing to help things along in the romance department. All she did all night was crab and complain about everything under the sun, including how much she hated that bird Roy had up at the store, and in between her complaints about Jack, she managed to tell several blue jokes that Oswald laughed at. Frances smiled, but was secretly horrified and wanted to strangle her sister. How was she ever going to get a man? A perfectly good dinner wasted, as far as she was concerned. The next day, true to form, Mildred was back down at the store, fussing at Jack, who fluttered around her head. She said, You've heard about the 4-and-20 blackbirds baked in a pie? Well, mister, I'm going to bake one big redbird pie if you don't quit pestering me. Roy laughed. You better watch out, boy, or she'll have you for dinner one day. Despite all her complaints, Roy liked Mildred a lot. He got a kick out of her and how she was always dyeing her hair different colors. Besides, as Oswald had just found out, she sure could tell a joke. After just a few weeks, Oswald found that he was beginning to get into a routine. Every morning after breakfast, he would go to the store, hang around a while, and then go down to the dock to smoke cigarettes and wait for Claude Underwood to come by with the mail. He didn't dare smoke in Betty's house. As he sat waiting, sometimes for an hour or two, he saw that the river was full of things he had never seen before. All kinds of large birds, loons and egrets, geese and ducks of different kinds swam up and down the river. A few swam in pairs, but most were in flocks that took off together and landed in the water together. One day, while he was waiting, Oswald noticed a black duck out in the river all by himself, and he wondered about it. Why did this one lone duck not swim with a mate or with the flock? Did the duck even know he was supposed to be with the others? What had caused that duck to separate from the rest? The more he watched it out there swimming around, the sadder it made him. He realized he was just like that duck. All his life, he had been out in the world alone while the rest of the world swam by, happy in their own flock, knowing who they were and where they belonged. Oswald was feeling a little sad these days anyway. Christmas was just around the corner, and Betty was already playing Christmas carols on the radio. He supposed it put some people in a good mood, but all those, "I'll be home for Christmas" and "There's no place like home for the holidays" songs just made him feel lousy. For him, Christmas had always been a season with everything set up just to break your heart. As a kid, all he had ever gotten were cheap toys handed out by a bunch of once-a-year do-gooders, toys that by the next day were either broken or stolen. Even as an adult, when he had spent the holidays with Helen's family, it just made him feel more of an outsider than ever. Each year was the same. All her brothers and sisters would sit around looking at home movies and reminiscing about their wonderful childhood Christmases. No Christmas for him had always been like someone shining a great big spotlight down in that dark, empty space inside him, and the only way he had been able to handle it in the past was to get drunk. A hangover was nothing compared to feeling all alone in a room full of people. This year he would be spending what could turn out to be his very last Christmas on the river with the birds and ducks. That, he guessed, was better than nothing. The next time Oswald went in the store, he found himself eyeing the cartons of beer stacked over in the corner and was almost headed over there, but when Betty Kitchen came in, he decided to stick to his original plan and asked Roy if there was some kind of book he could get so he could try and figure out what kinds of birds and ducks he was looking at. Roy said, "Come on back in the office with me. I think I have something for you." The office was a mess, with stacks of papers and old ledgers and Jack's toys everywhere, but Roy rummaged through a pile on the floor and handed Oswald an old ripped paperback copy of Birds of Alabama, a bird watcher's guide. "May I borrow this?" asked Oswald. "Oh, hell, you can have it. I don't need it." Oswald took the book up to his room. While he was thumbing through it, he found an old postcard from 1932 that described Lost River as a magical spot, invisible from the highway by reason of its location in masses of shade trees along the winding banks of the river, where it lies in a setting of flowers and foliage and songbirds, like a dream of beauty, ready for the brush and canvas of the landscape painter. That's the damn truth, he thought. It would be a great place for a painter or a bird watcher. Then it dawned on him that he, Oswald T. Campbell, was actually studying to become a bird watcher. Bird watching was certainly not one of the things he would ever have put on his things to do list. As a matter of fact, he had never even had a things to do list, and now it was almost too late to do anything. Oh, well, he thought, live and learn. Better late than never. And then he wondered why in the hell he was thinking in cliches. From that day on, after he had gone down and had a cup of coffee with Roy and shot the breeze with him for a while, he would take his bird watcher's guide and go down to the river and try to match the birds he was seeing with the pictures in the book. So far, he had identified a great blue heron that cracked him up by the way it walked. It picked its feet up and down as if it were stepping in molasses. He had seen cranes, a snowy egret, mallards, wood ducks, and a belted kingfisher, and by December 19th, he had already identified his first pileated woodpecker. He was hoping to see an osprey one of these days. On the morning of December 22nd, when Oswald walked over to the store for coffee with Roy, he saw that the huge cedar tree outside the community hall had been decorated with hundreds of Christmas ornaments and silver and gold tinsel. When he went in the store, he asked Roy who had done it. Roy shook his head. "We don't know. Every Christmas it happens overnight, and nobody knows who did it, but I have my theories. I think it's that bunch of crazy women that do it." "Who?" "Oh, Frances, Mildred, and Dottie. Probably Betty Kitchen is in on it, too. I can't prove it, but I'll tell you this. Anytime you see all of them wearing polka dots on the same day, watch out." Just then the door opened and Frances Cleverdon walked in, looking sunny and cheerful. "Well, good morning, Mr. Campbell," she said with a smile. "How are you getting along?" "Oh, fine," he said. "I hope you're coming to the annual Christmas Eve dinner at the community hall. Roy's coming, aren't you? We're going to have a lot of good food." Roy said, "I'll be there." "Hey, Frances, have you seen the tree yet?" He winked at Oswald as she turned around and looked across the street. "Well, for heaven's sake," she said, feigning surprise. "When did that happen?" "Last night." Frances turned to Oswald. "Last year, the same exact thing happened on the 23rd. I just wish I knew who was doing it." "Yeah, me too," said Roy. "I was just telling Mr. Campbell it's a mystery, all right." Walking back home, Frances was so pleased. The polka dots had done it again. Frances and Betty Kitchen had started the club 12 years ago, and the founding members, after herself and Betty, were Sybil Underwood and, later, Dottie Nivens and Mildred. They had named themselves after a Mardi Gras group over in Mobile because they wanted to have fun as well as do good works. And thanks to Dottie Nivens and her amazing ability to make delicious highballs, which they drank out of polka-dotted martini glasses after every meeting, they did have fun. When their friend Elizabeth Shivers over in Lillian heard about it, she started another secret society, the Mystic Order of the Royal Dotted Swiss. They also did a lot of good work, but Frances was convinced that they could never top the Mystery Tree Caper. Chapter 7, The Christmas Dinner. Oswald had always been shy and was no good at social events. Although it was the last thing on earth he wanted to do, it seemed that on Christmas Eve he had no choice but to put on his one blue suit and tie and go with Betty and her mother to the dinner and tree lighting ceremony at the community hall. It was made clear to him over and over that everyone was expecting him. So at 5:30, he and Betty Kitchen and her mother, Miss Alma, wearing three giant red camellias in her hair, strolled down the street. It was still about 69 degrees outside, and hard for Oswald to believe it was really December 24th. When they arrived, the hall was already packed with people, and the minute they saw Oswald, everyone made a point to come up and shake his hand and welcome him to the area. After about 30 minutes of being pulled around the room like a wooden toy, Oswald was thrilled to see Roy Grimmett come in, looking as uncomfortable in his blue suit and tie as Oswald felt in his. At around 6:30, after a prayer was said, it was time to eat, and someone called out, "Let Mr. Campbell start the line." Oswald was handed a plate and pushed to the long table full of more food than he had ever seen. Fried chicken, ham, turkey, roast beef, pork chops, chicken and dumplings, and every kind of vegetables, pies, and cakes you can imagine. At the end sat two huge, round, cut-glass punch bowls of thick, delicious-smelling eggnog. One was labeled leaded. The other bowl said unleaded. Oswald hesitated for a moment and seriously thought about it, but at the last second went for the unleaded. He did not want to get drunk and make a fool out of himself and embarrass Frances. After all, everyone knew she was responsible for getting him there. The long tables with their white tablecloths had centerpieces decorated with sprigs of fresh holly and pine cones that had been dipped in either shellac or gold or silver paint and sprinkled with glitter. On the pine walls hung red paper bells. Huge red paper bells hung from twisted red and green crepe paper that wrapped around the room, interspersed with pictures of the Nativity. Oswald sat next to Betty's mother, and Betty sat on the other side, and about halfway through the dinner, the old lady punched him in the ribs and said, "Ask me what time it is." "Okay," he said, "what time is it?" "Half past kissing time, time to kiss again," she said, then screamed with laughter and continued to repeat it over and over until Betty had to get up and take her home. It seems Miss Alma had gotten into the leaded eggnog. Oswald had just dropped whipped cream from the sweet potato pie all down the front of his tie when Dottie Nivens, the president of the association, made an announcement. "Before we start the program this evening, We have a first-time visitor with us tonight, and I would like for him to stand up and tell us a little bit about himself. Everyone clapped, and they all turned around and smiled at him and sat waiting for him to speak. Oswald's ears turned as red as the bells on the wall. Francis, seeing how uncomfortable he was, quickly stood up and said, "Keep your seat, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Campbell is my guest tonight, and I can tell you, he came all the way down here from Chicago to get away from bad old cold winter and to spend the winter with us, and maybe longer if we don't run him off with all our crazy doings." They all laughed. "So welcome to the community, Mr. Campbell." They all clapped again, and he made an attempt at a nod. The program for the evening was a reading of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas by Dottie Nivens, an unfortunate selection for a woman with a lisp, followed by a solo rendition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer played on the musical saw, and ending with a visit from Santa Claus, who came in the room with a large sack thrown over his shoulder. Santa sat in the front and called out the names of the children in the room, and one by one, each went up for their present. Oswald noticed that when they got back to the table and opened their packages, they all seemed to like what they got. After everyone had received gifts, Santa Claus stood up and said, "Well, that's all, boys and girls." But then, as he lifted his sack, he pretended to find just one more present. "Oh, wait a minute," he said. "Here's another one." He read the card, looked out, and asked, "Is there a little boy here named Oswald T. Campbell?" Everybody laughed and pointed. "Come on up, Oswald," said Santa. When he got there, Oswald saw it was Claude Underwood, under the beard, who asked, "Have you been a good boy?" Oswald laughed and said he had, received his present, and went back to his seat. The evening ended with the lighting of the tree. As soon as everyone was outside, they all mashed together in a large clump, and Oswald found himself in the middle. He could not help but think about the photo and the old hotel brochure of those 30 people standing under a rose bush. People in Alabama must love to stand around in clumps. Butch Manich was stationed in the doorway. When the children standing over to the side, mashed together in their own smaller clump, started singing, "O Christmas Tree," he switched on the lights and they all applauded. After it was over, Oswald walked home with Francis and Mildred. He told them the most amazing thing about the evening to him, besides all the food, was that all the kids seemed to love their presents. He said he almost never liked what he had gotten for Christmas. They smiled and explained that the reason they were all so pleased was because each year, Dottie Nivens, the postmistress, opened the letters they had written to Santa Claus and told their parents exactly what they wanted. As they walked further up the street, Oswald noticed that one side of the sky seemed to be glowing red off in the distance. Francis told him it was caused by the fires the Creoles lit along the riverbanks every Christmas Eve to light up the night for Papa Christmas and help him find his way to the homes of the Creole children. "We used to go and watch him come up the river, but we don't go over there anymore," she said. Although it was around 10 o'clock, the night was still mild, and it was very pleasant with the moonlight shining through the trees. Walking past all the houses with their Christmas lights twinkling in the windows. As they strolled along in silence, listening to the night birds singing, Oswald suddenly began to experience an unfamiliar feeling he could not quite identify. He was actually glad he had gone to the dinner. It had not been that bad after all. When he got home, Betty, who was downstairs in her nightgown with cold cream on her face, said, "You don't have to worry about waking Mother up tonight. She's as drunk as a skunk and out like a light. So maybe I'll finally get some rest." When he got upstairs to his room, he unwrapped his present and saw that it was a brand new hard copy of Birds of Alabama. It was signed Merry Christmas from the Lost River Community Association. It was just what he wanted, and he had not even written Santa a letter. The gift was really from Claude and Roy. A few days before Christmas, Claude had told Roy he felt sorry for Mr. Campbell. Why? Ah, the poor guy. He comes down to that dock waiting for the mail, and all he ever gets is some pension check from the government. The whole time he's been here, he hasn't received one personal letter. Not even one lousy Christmas card. What they did not know was that Oswald did not expect to receive any mail. He was down at the dock every day only because he did not have anywhere else to go except to the store and back to his room again. All he was doing was just sitting around killing time, looking at the birds, and waiting to die. Being aware that his days were numbered was not easy. Oswald found the hardest part was to wake up each morning with nothing to look forward to but getting worse. From what the doctor had told him, Oswald had assumed that as time passed, he would start to feel weaker and weaker. However, on December 31st, he woke up and noticed he was not coughing as much as he used to. He was really starting to feel pretty good, and somehow, for the first time in his life, certainly for the first time since he was 15, he had actually managed to get through Christmas sober. In the past, he had never been able to get more than 1 year in AA because he could never make it through the holidays without falling off the wagon, usually on Christmas Day. And also, for the first time, he was experiencing another unfamiliar feeling. He was proud of himself and wished he could had someone to tell. Not only had he made it through Christmas, he had also put on about 5 extra pounds since he had been here, and he noticed in the mirror that he had a lot more color in his cheeks. This place was obviously agreeing with him. Damn, he thought, if he hadn't known better, he could have sworn he was better. On New Year's Day, Francis and Betty and everybody up and down the street made him come in, and they all insisted that he eat a big bowl of black-eyed peas. They said it was good luck to eat them on New Year's Day, and by that night he was up to his ears in black-eyed peas. Maybe they were right. Maybe he would get lucky and last a little longer than he had expected. A few mornings later, when Oswald sat down for breakfast, Betty announced, "Well, Mr. Campbell, you're famous. You've made the papers." And she handed him a copy of the local newsletter that came out once a month. Along the River, the Lost River Community Association newsletter. Oh my, what a busy and happy Christmas season we had on the river. Everyone agreed that the mystery tree was prettier than ever this year. Kudos to those secret elves who must have come down from the North Pole to surprise us yet again. If we only knew who they were, we would thank them in person. Christmas Eve dinner was especially delicious. We are mightily blessed with an abundance of good cooks down here, and mucho thanks to the good ladies and gents who made the hall so festive and so full of Christmas cheer. A special nod goes to Sybil Underwood, who supplied the centerpieces. We are all amazed at what she can do with only simple pine cones and a few sprigs of holly. Thanks also to husband Claude for the fried mullet. Yum, yum. We had the largest crowd ever. And it was good to see Betty Kitchen's mother, Miss Alma, out and about again. As usual, the highlight of the evening for the children was a visit by good old Santa Claus himself. All the boys and girls loved their presents, including our newest member, Mr. Oswald T. Campbell. Welcome! The evening ended as usual with the annual tree lighting ceremony, and amid the oohs and ahs of the crowd, I heard someone say that those folks up at Rockefeller Center in New York have nothing on us. I could not agree more. And so ends another Christmas season, with all of us worn down to a frazzle and exhausted from all the busy activity, but already looking forward to next year's Happy Noel. In the meantime, all you lovebirds out there, married or single, don't forget to grab your sweetheart for the annual Valentine's dinner on February 14th. Yours truly. And Frances Cleverdon will be the hostess again this year, and we promise that love will definitely be in the air. Signed, Dottie Nivens. After he finished reading, Betty said, "You know, Mr. Campbell, Dottie's no stranger to the written word. When she was younger, she had herself quite a little literary fling up there in Manhattan." "Is that so?" he said, although he was not surprised. She certainly did look the artistic type, since she usually wore a long black scarf and a black velvet beret on her head. "Oh, yes," said Betty. "She lived in Greenwich Village and was a genuine bohemian, from what I understand. Dottie told me she thought she was going to be the next Edna Ferber or Pearl Buck, but it didn't work out, so she had to get a job." "That's too bad," he said. "Yes, but she's a good sport about it. When Dottie became our official postmistress, she said she'd always hoped she'd wind up a woman of letters, and this was not quite what she had in mind." Oswald understood how she felt. He had always dreamed of becoming an architect someday, but instead wound up working as a draftsman all his life. His ambitions had never quite panned out either. he might have a lot more in common with her than he had thought, which would please Francis. Although Oswald did not know it, in her secret scheme to get him married, Dottie Nivens was second in line to get him if he and Mildred did not work out. And at the moment, that did not seem to be going anywhere, at least as far as she could glean from Mildred. After that first dinner with Oswald at her house, she had tried her best to get at least a clue as to how she felt. After he had left that night, she had asked Mildred, "Well, what do you think?" Mildred had looked at her as if she had no idea what she meant. About what? She knew full well what Francis had meant and was just being cantankerous to irritate her. But far be it from Mildred to tell her what she was really thinking. Sunday mornings in Lost River were quiet. Almost everyone, including Betty Kitchen and her mother, went over to the little town of Lillian for church. Francis and Mildred had asked Oswald to go with them, but he was not a church-going man. Another person who did not go was Claude Underwood, who went fishing. When asked why, he told everyone that he attended the Church of the Speckled Trout and would much rather be on the river than be in a suit and tie cooped up in some hot, stuffy building. One Sunday in early January, Claude rode by the dock, noticed Oswald sitting there in his chair with his book, and pulled over to him. "I see the girls haven't drug you off to Lillian with them," Claude said, smiling. "No, they tried, but I escaped." "What are you doing?" "Oh, nothing, just looking." "Then why don't you come fishing with me?" "I don't know how to fish. Could I just tag along for the ride?" "Sure, get in." So it was a clear, bright blue morning, and the sun sparkled on the water as Claude rode all the way up to the wide part of the river. Flocks of pelicans flew beside the boat, almost close enough to reach out and touch. While they were sitting in the middle of the river, the river was so still and peaceful, the only sound was the faint whirring of Claude's fishing reel and the soft plop as the lure hit the water. Oswald was amazed at the ease and grace with which Claude cast his line out and drew it back with almost no effort. While they were sitting there in the quiet, Oswald heard church bells ringing way off in the distance. He asked Claude where they were coming from. "That's the Creole church across the river. You can hear it sometimes if the wind is right," he laughed. "Sometimes on Saturday night you can hear them playing their music, whooping and hollering and carrying on. They like to have a good time. I'll say that for them." "Do any of the Creoles ever come over to our side of the river?" Claude sighed. "They used to, but not anymore." "What are they like?" "Most of them are as nice as you could want. Would give you the shirt off their backs. I had a lot of good Creole friends at one time, but after that thing with Roy and Julian, we just don't mix. After that happened, everybody was more or less forced to take sides. Since the Creoles are all pretty much related to one another, they had to side with Julian, whether they agreed with him or not. and all of us over here had to do the same. It's sort of a Hatfield and McCoy kind of a thing, I guess. We don't go over there, they don't come over here. Oswald, curious, asked, "So, what happened? Didn't the women tell you about it?" "No." Claude threw his line out in the water and began to reel it back in. "Well, back about 17 or maybe 18 years by now, we had ourselves a real-life Romeo and Juliet situation, and it's a dang miracle somebody wasn't murdered over it. It was touch and go there for a long while, with threats going back and forth across the river. Roy swore he was going to kill Julian, and Julian swore he was going to kill Roy, and to this day there's still a lot of bad blood between them. I think if either one of them got caught on the wrong side of the river, look out." Roy seemed like such an even-tempered man to Oswald. "Do you really think Roy would kill him?" "You better believe it. Julian would do the same if he got the chance, and it's a damn shame, too. Roy was practically raised by Julian and thought the world of him until that mess over Julian's daughter. I don't know the exact details of what happened, but the women do. I'm sure there is right and wrong on both sides, but I do think Julian's pride caused most of the trouble." "Really?" "Oh, yeah. Back in the 1700s, in the LaPond family, they used to own all of Baldwin County, all the way up to Mobile. Julian's great-grandfather got the original land grant from the King of Spain, but over the years, the family sold most of it off, bit by bit, got cheated out of some of it, lost a lot of it in poker games, and eventually wound up with just the land on the other side of the river." A small boat came around the corner, and two men waved at Claude. "Have any luck?" Claude waved back. "Not much," he said as they went by. "Anyhow, about 60 years ago, some of the farmers that came down to Baldwin County and bought land thought the Creoles were just a little too dark for their tastes, and also they were Catholic and did their share of drinking, and that didn't set too well with the farmers. So there was some talk about maybe they shouldn't be going to the same schools as their children, and eventually there was going to be some sort of vote. But Julian's father got wind of it, and he pulled all the Creoles out of the county school and started one of their own. Julian was just a kid then, and he swore that when he grew up, he was going to get his family's original Spanish land grant back and kick the farmers off their land, or some such crazy idea. He wanted his daughter, Marie, to marry the Voltaire boy so he could get some of the La Pond land back in the family, but Marie wanted to marry Roy. As I say, I don't know what all took place, but after it was over, the girl wound up marrying the Voltaire boy, and Roy ran off and joined the Marines. Oswald had not been aware that Claude had hooked something while he was talking, but at that moment, Claude casually reached over and pulled a mean-looking fish with a long, skinny snout full of teeth out of the water and into the boat. "What is that?" asked Oswald, moving aside. "This old boy is a gar. Puts up a nice little fight, but not good to eat," he said, unhooking the fish. "Putting him back in the water," he said. "Sorry, fella." The next week, when Oswald went over to have dinner with Francis and Mildred again, he asked Francis about the feud between Roy and Julian LePond. Francis looked at him. "Oh, Mr. Campbell, you don't even want to know about that. It was just terrible. I just don't want to tell you how awful it was." She then sat down on the couch and proceeded to tell him the entire story. "When that mess was going on, Ralph, my poor husband, had to get up and go down there in the middle of the night and help try and stop Roy from going across the river and killing Julian. And evidently, from what I heard, his relatives had to hold Julian back from coming over here and killing Roy. Julian accused Roy of ruining his girl's reputation or some such nonsense and said he was going to shoot him if he got the chance. Ralph said poor Roy was down at the store having a fit. He was so in love with Marie LePond. And you can't blame him. She was a beautiful girl. But then, as mean as he was, Julian was always a good-looking man. You have to say that for him, don't you, Mildred?" Mildred, who tonight had black hair with a white streak down the middle, said, "I don't know. I never saw the man." "Oh, that's right," said Francis. "You weren't here yet, but he was as good-looking as a movie star with those blue-green eyes. All the women were crazy about him." Anyhow, Roy and Marie had practically grown up together and had been in love with each other since they were children. So when he was 18, Roy told Julian that he and Marie wanted to get married, and Julian had a fit and said no, absolutely not, that the only way Roy could marry Marie was over his dead body. Marie's mother, who loved Roy like a son, begged Julian to change his mind, and so did Roy's uncle, who was his good friend. But he would not budge. He claimed he was against it because Roy was not Catholic, but the truth was Julian wanted that Voltaire land back, and the only way he could get his hands on it was to have Marie marry into the family. So when all else failed, Roy somehow got a note to Marie and rode over there late one night to get her so they could run off and get married. But Julian caught them just as they were leaving the dock and dragged Marie out of the boat and shot at Roy. Oh, it was terrible. People said they heard poor Marie screaming and crying and pleading with her father all the way across the river. The very next day, Julian took Marie off and stuck her in a convent somewhere where Roy couldn't find her. Mildred said, "Why didn't she just leave? That's what I would have done." "I don't think it was that easy, Mildred. I think she was afraid her father would hurt Roy. Or maybe, being a good Catholic girl, she felt obligated to do what he said. But anyway, about a year later, she managed to get a letter to Roy and told him she had decided to go ahead and marry the Voltaire boy. And do you know what the worst part of this story is? Mildred, who had already knocked back two vodka martinis, said that the dinner is getting cold. Frances ignored her sister and continued, "The worst part is after all that, the Voltaire boy lost all his family's land gambling, and he and Marie had to move to Louisiana. So Julian broke two hearts and destroyed two lives, all for naught. It's a real life tragedy, so we just don't talk about it. Especially to Roy. I know he's still in love with her." Mildred turned to Oswald. "It sounds like the plot of a really bad novel, doesn't it?" "You should know," thought Frances as she stood up to go to the kitchen, but she did not say it. She did not want Mr. Campbell to know what kind of junk her sister read and wished Mildred could be more like Dottie Nivens, who at least aspired to better herself. She read great literature, Chaucer, Proust, and Jane Austen, not those cheap romance novels Mildred always picked. As she pulled the roast out of her pink stove, she also wondered why Mildred had worn that low-cut blouse that showed the top of her more than generous wherewithals. Was she interested in Mr. Campbell, or was she just not paying attention to what she put on? With Mildred, you never knew. Chapter 8. A Small Visitor. One afternoon, Oswald was standing around the cash register talking with Roy, when Roy suddenly picked up a pencil, pretended to be writing something, and said, "Don't look now, but that little girl I was telling you about is back." The first time Roy had seen the little girl was a few weeks before, and then it was only the top of a small blonde head slowly rising up and appearing in the side window, then two big wide blue eyes staring in at Jack running on his plastic wheel and ringing his bells. But the minute she saw Roy, she quickly disappeared from sight. Roy walked back and went outside, but by the time he got around the side of the building, she was nowhere to be seen. He had noticed her only a few times, but it was always the same. As soon as she saw him looking at her, she disappeared into the thin air. The next time she came, he was able to catch sight of her before she saw him. He quickly turned his back and pretended not to notice her. From what he had seen of her, she was a pretty little thing and was clearly shy and afraid of people, but obviously fascinated with the bird. She came every day after that, and Roy got a big kick out of it. "Who is she?" asked Oswald, not turning around. "I don't know. I've asked Frances and Dottie, but nobody knows who she is or where she came from. I just wish I could get her to come in." As the days went by, the girl became bolder and bolder until one afternoon when Roy opened the back door, she did not run away. "Don't you want to come inside?" he said. "He can't come out, but if you come in, you can pet him if you want. He won't mind." Roy, seeing how small she was, guessed the girl could not have been more than 5 or 6. She was barefoot and wearing a dirty ribbed cotton dress, and she stood there, clearly torn between being terrified of Roy and wanting to see Jack up close. "Come on in," he said. "Nobody's going to hurt you." The girl started to turn around and leave, but Roy said, "Wait a minute, don't go," and went back in and picked Jack up and held his feet between his forefinger and thumb and walked to the door so she could see him. "Look, you can hold him if you want. He's tame. He won't hurt you." Jack looked at her through the screen and sang out, "Chip, chip, birdie, birdie, birdie." After a moment, the girl could not resist and slowly began to move toward the door. It was then Roy noticed that there was something wrong with her. As she came closer and closer, he could see that her body was slightly twisted and she was dragging her right leg behind her. "What's your name?" he asked, and she came in with her eyes never leaving Jack. She answered, "Patsy," so softly he could barely hear her. "Well, Patsy, this is Jack." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of our book. I do hope you're enjoying it. It's such a sweet story. Please tune in again next week. This is Peggy Van Skoik reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our programs are made for people who are blind or print impaired.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Larissa Biggers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is poetry. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from a variety of sources, and our topic is winter poems. The first poem I'm going to read is called Early Frost by Scott Cairns. This morning, the world's white face reminds us that life intends to become serious again. And the same loud birds that all summer long annoyed us with their high attitudes and chatter silently line the gibbet of fence, a little stunned, chastened enough. They look as if they're waiting for things to grow worse, but are watching the house, as if somewhere in their dim memories they recall something about this abandoned garden that could save them. The neighbor's dog has also learned to wake without exaggeration, and the neighbor himself has made it to his car with less noise, starting the small engine with a kind of reverence. At the window, his wife witnesses this bleak tableau, blinking her eyes, silent. I fill the feeders to the top and cart them to the tree, hurrying back inside to leave the morning to these ridiculous birds who, reminded, find the rough shelters, bow, and then feed. The next poem I'm going to read is by Mary Oliver, and it's called White Eyes. White Eyes. In the winter, all the singing is in the tops of the trees, where the wind bird, with its white eyes, shoves and pushes among the branches. Like any of us, he wants to go to sleep, but he's restless. He has an idea, and slowly it unfolds from under his beating wings as long as he stays awake. But his big, round music, after all, is too breathy to last. So it's over. In the pine crown, he makes his nest. He's done all he can. I don't know the name of the bird. I only imagine his glittering beak tucked in a white wing while the clouds, which he has summoned from the north, which he has taught to be mild and silent, thicken and begin to fall into the world below like stars or the feathers of some unimaginable bird that loves us, that is asleep now and silent, that has turned itself into snow. The next poem is called Snow by A. Zing. It's translated from the Chinese. Snow. Listening to the snow on earth, falling above us from an unknown space. Sky darkens. A line of poetry is half complete. The shepherd and his sheep are coming down from the hill through thorns, wetland, exposed on the Gobi. Snow is decorating the cosmos as we seek our path to get back home, and the mountains are joyful. On the open river banks, rocks and sheep move slowly. Only gods can tell their difference, perhaps. Studded against the white-out snow, the shepherd stands like a sore black word. The next poem is called The Snow is Deep on the Ground, and it's by Kenneth Patchen. The snow is deep on the ground. Always the light falls softly down on the hair of my beloved. This is a good world. The war has failed. God shall not forget us. Who made the snow waits where love is. Only a few go mad. The sky moves in its whiteness like the withered hand of an old king. God shall not forget us. Who made the sky knows of our love. The snow is beautiful on the ground, and always the lights of heaven glow softly down on the hair of my beloved. The next poem I'm going to read is by Robert Frost. It's called Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest hour of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sound's a sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. The next poem is by Emily Jungmin Yoon, and it's called Between Autumn Equinox and Winter Solstice Today. Between Autumn Equinox and Winter Solstice Today. I read a Korean poem with the line, "Today you are the youngest you will ever be. Today I'm the oldest I have been. Today we drink buckwheat tea. Today I have heat in my apartment. Today I think about the word chada in Korean. It means cold. It means to be filled with. It means to kick, to wear. Today we're worn. Today you wear the cold, your chilled skin. My heart kicks on my skin. Someone said winter has broken his windows. The heat inside and the cold outside sent lightning across glass. Today, my heart wears you like curtains. Today it fills you. The window in my room is full of leaves ready to fall. Chada, you say. It's tea. We drink. It is cold outside. This poem is by William Carlos Williams, and it's called Blizzard. Snow. Years of anger following hours that float idly down. The blizzard drifts its weight deeper and deeper for 3 days, or 60 years, eh? Then the sun, a clutter of yellow and blue flakes. Hairy-looking trees stand out in long alleys over a wild solitude. The man turns, and there, his solitary track stretched out upon the world. The next poem is by Megan Fernandez, and it's called Winter. Winter. One winter, I became very quiet and saw my life. It was February, outside in the city streets. Snow fell, but would not collect. I bought snapdragons and thistle, got some discount peach roses that smelled off. I split them between vases and moved the bouquets from room to room while a violin solo rang out. My throat hurt. My tonsils grew blubbery like two fat snails kissing in a slow arc. A detective show played. I wanted a cigarette and Jimmy Stewart in my bed. Nightly, I dreamt of epileptic Dostoevsky in Siberia with only the New Testament to read and thought of that mock execution from which he never recovered. 4 years he spent there in the dead cold. I have two cats in New York, and not so much loneliness. Still, I prepare for their deaths. But who knows? I may go first. Sorry, but I'm like this in winter. My composure, an evergreen, with a settled world that keeps settling. I trek the season. I arrange the dance of blooms room to room and keep my small perimeter fed and alive. We tread to march like soldiers tossed into navy tides, into white wave, and who, spotting land at last, grow gills at its sight. This poem is by Marge Piercy, and it's called The Air Smelled Dirty. The air smelled dirty. Everybody burned coal in our neighborhood. Soft coal, they called it, from the mountains of western Pennsylvania, where my father grew up and fled as soon as he could, where my Welch cousins dug it down in the dark. The furnace it fed stood in the dank basement, its many arms upraised like Godzilla or some other monster. It was my job to pull out the clinkers and carry them to the alley bin. Mornings were chilly, frost on windows etching magic landscapes. I liked to stand over the hot air register, the warmth blowing up my skirts, but the basement scared me at night. The fire glowed like a red eye through the furnace door, and the clinkers fell loud, and the shadows came at me as mice scampered. The washing machine was tame, but the furnace was always hungry. This poem is called Winter Morning, and it's by James Cruz. Winter Morning. When I can no longer say thank you for this new day and the waking into it, for the cold scrape of the kitchen chair and the ticking of space heater glowing orange as it warms the floor near my feet, I know it's because I've been fooled again by the selfish, unruly man who lives in me and believes he deserves only safety and comfort. But if I pause, as I do now, and watch the streetlights outside, flashing off one by one like old men blinking their cloudy eyes, if I listen to my tired neighbors slamming car doors hard against the morning and see the steaming coffee in their mugs, kissing chapped lips as they sip and exhale, each of their worries white into the icy air around their faces, then I can remember this one life as a gift each of us was handed and told to open. Untie the bow and tear off the paper. Look inside and be grateful for whatever you find, even if it's only the scent of a tangerine that lingers on the fingers long after you've finished peeling it. This next poem is called It Would Be Neat If With the New Year, and it's by Jimmy Santiago Baca. It would be neat if with the new year, for Miguel. It would be neat if with the new year, I could leave my loneliness behind with the old year, my leathery loneliness, an old pair of work boots my dog vigorously head shakes back and forth in its jaws, chews on for hours every day in my front yard, rain, sun, snow, or wind, in bare feet, pondering my poem, I'd look out of the window and see that dirty pair of boots in the yard. But my happiness depends so much on wearing those boots. At the end of my day, while I'm in a chair listening to a Mexican corrido, I stare at the boots, appreciating all the wrong roads we've taken, all the drug and whiskey houses we've visited, and the Mexican singer wails his pain. I smile at the boots, understanding every note in his voice, and strangers, when they see my boots rocking back, and forth on my feet, keeping beat to the song, see how my boots are scuffed, tooth marked, worn soled. I keep wearing them because they fit so good, and I need them, especially when I love so hard, where I go up those boulder strewn trails, where flowers crack rocks and their defiant love for the light. This poem is called First Snow, and it's by author Sez, and that's S-Z-E. First Snow. A rabbit has stopped on the gravel driveway, imbibing the silence. You stare at spruce needles. There's no sound of a leaf blower, no sign of black bear. A few weeks ago, a buck scraped his rack against an aspen truck. A carpenter scribed a plank along a curved stone wall. You only spot the rabbit's ears and tail when it moves. You locate it against speckled gravel, but when it stops, it blends in again. The world of being is like this gravel. You think you own a car, a house, a blue zigzag shirt, but you just borrow these things. Yesterday, you constructed an aqueduct of dreams and stood at Gibraltar, but you possess nothing. Snow melts into a pool of clear water, and in the stillness, straight behind, daylight, wherever you gaze. Pardon me, the last line is starlight. Behind daylight, wherever you gaze. This poem is called Beyond the Red River, and it's by Thomas McGrath. Beyond the Red River. The birds have flown their summer skies to the south, and the flower money is drying in the banks of bent grass, which the bumblebee has abandoned. We wait for a winter lion. Body of ice crystals and sombrero of dead leaves. A month ago, from the salt engines of the sea, a machinery of early storms rolled in toward the holiday houses, where summer still dozed in the poolside chairs, sipping an aging whiskey of distances and departures. Now, the long freight of autumn goes smoking out of the land. My possibilities are all packed up, but I still do not leave. I'm happy enough here, where Dakota drifts wild in the universe, where the prairie is starting to shake in the surf of the winter dark. The next poem is called Ice, and it's by Gail Mazur. Ice. In the warming house, children lace their skates, bending choked over their thick jackets. A Franklin stove keeps the place so cozy, it's hard to imagine why anyone would leave. Clumping across the frozen beach to the river. December's always the same at Ware's Cove, the first sheer ice, black, then white, and deep until the city sends trucks of men with wooden barriers to put up the boys' hockey rink. An hour of skating after school, of trying wobbly figure eights, an hour of distances moved backwards without falling, then twilight. The warming house steamy with girls pulling on boots, their chafed legs aching. Outside, the hockey players keep playing, slamming the round black puck until it's dark, until supper. At night, a shy girl comes to the cove with her father. Although there isn't music, they glide arm in arm into the blurred surface together, braced like dancers. She thinks she'll never be so happy, for who else will find her graceful, find her perfect? skate with her in circles outside the empty rink forever. This poem is called A January Dandelion by George Marion McClellan. A January Dandelion. All Nashville is a chill, and everywhere, like desert sand when the winds blow, there is each a moment sifted through the air, a powdered blast of January snow. Oh, thoughtless dandelion, to be misled by a few warm days to leave thy natural bed, was folly growth and blooming over soon. And yet, thou blasted yellow-coated gem, full many a heart has but a common boon with thee now freezing on thy slender stem. When the heart has bloomed by the touch of love's warm breath, then left and chilling snow is sifted in, it may still beat, but there is blast and death to all that blooming life that might have been. This poem is called Crossing the Square by Grace Shulman. Crossing the Square. Squinting through ice slits in our baklavas, we lurch across Washington Square Park. Hunched against the wind, two hooded figures caught in the monochrome, carrying sacks of fruit as we've done for years. The frosted, starch-stiff sycamores make a lean Christmas tree seem to bulk larger, tilted under the arch and still lit in three colors. Once, in January, we found a feather here and stuffed the quill and twigs to recall that jay. The musical fountain is here, its water gone, a limestone circle now. Though rap succeeds, the bluegrass strains we've played it in, new praise evokes old sounds. White branches mimic visions of past storms. Some say they've heard ghosts moan above this ground, once a potter's field. No two stones are the same, of course. The drums, the tawny pears we hold, are old masks for new things. Still, in a world where fretted houses with facades are leveled for condominiums, not much has altered here. At least it's faithful to imagined views. And, after all, we know the sycamore will screen the sky in a receding wind. Now, trekking home through grit that's mounting higher, faces upturned to test the whirling snow and new mask, we whistle to make breath clouds form and disappear and form again, and oh, my love, there's sun in the crook of your arm. This poem is called Last Snow, and it's by Heidi E. Erdrich. Last Snow. Dumped wet and momentary on a dull ground that's been clear but clearly seeping for days, last snow melts as it falls, piles up slush, runs in light, making a music in the streets we wish we could keep. Last snow. That's what we'll think for weeks to come. Close sun sets up a glare that smarts like a good cry. We could head north and north and never let the season go. Stubborn beast. The body reads the past and the change of light, knows the blow of grief and the time of trees' tight-fisted leaves, stubborn calendar of bone. Last snow. Now it must always be snow. This poem is called The Snow Fairy, and it's by Claude McKay. The Snow Fairy. 1. Throughout the afternoon I watched them there, snow fairies falling from the sky, whirling fantastic in the misty air, contending fierce for space supremacy. And they flew down a mightier force at night, as though in heaven there was a revolt and riot, and they, frail things, had taken panic flight down to the calm earth, seeking peace and quiet. I went to bed and rose at early dawn to see them huddled together in a heap, each merged into the other upon the lawn, worn out by sharp struggle, fast asleep. The sun shone brightly on them half the day. By night, they stealthily had stolen away. 2. And suddenly, my thoughts then turned to you, who came to me upon a winter's night when snow sprites round my attic window flew, your hair disheveled, eyes aglow with light. My heart was like the weather when you came, The wanton winds were blowing loud and long, but you, with joy and passion all aflame, you danced and sang a lilting summer song. I made room for you in my little bed, took covers from the closet fresh and warm, a downful pillow for your scented head, and lay down with you resting on my arm. You went with dawn, you left me ere the day, the lonely actor of a dreamy play. This poem is called Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him, who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austerity and lonely offices? This poem is called Back Soon, Driving, by Carl Phillips. Back Soon, Driving. The way the present cuts into history, or how the future can look at first, like the past sweeping through, there are blizzards, and there are blizzards. Some contain us, some we carry within us until they die, when we do. The snow falls here, the snow falls there, barely snowing, into a long wooden trough where the cattle feed on those apples we used to call medieval, or I did, for their smallish size, as if medieval meant the world in miniature, but not so different otherwise from our own, just smaller, a bit sweeter, more prone, therefore, to rot quickly, which is maybe not the worst thing. Revelation is not disclosure. I love how the snow, taking itself now more seriously, makes the cattle look softer for a moment than their hard bodies are. This poem is called The Same City by Terrence Hayes for James L. Hayes. The Same City. The rain falling on a night in mid-December, I pull to my father's engine, wondering how long I'll remember this. His car is dead. He connects jumper cables to his battery, then to mine without looking in at me and the child. Water beads on the windshields, the road sign, his thin blue coat. I'd get out now, prove I can stand with him in the cold, but he told me to stay with the infant. I wrap her in the blanket, staring for what seems like a long time into her open, toothless mouth, and wish she were mine. I feed her an orange softened first in my mouth, chew gently until the juices run down my fingers as I squeeze it into hers. What could any of this matter to another man passing on his way to his family, his radio deafening the sound of water and breathing along the roads bound to his? But to rescue a soul is as close as anyone comes to God. Think of Noah lifting the small black bird from its nest. Think of Joseph raising a son that wasn't his. Let me begin again. I want to be holy. In rain, I pull up to my father's car with my girlfriend's infant. She was 8 weeks pregnant when we met, but we'd made love. We'd made love below stars and shingles while her baby kicked between us. Perhaps a man whose young child bears his face, whose wife waits as he drives home through rain and darkness, perhaps that man would call me a fool. So what? There is one thing I will remember all my life. It is as small and holy as the mouth of an infant. It is speechless. When his car would not stir, my father climbed in beside us, took the orange from my hand, took the baby in his arms. In 1974, this man met my mother for the first time, as I cried or slept, in the same city that holds us tonight. If you ever tell my story, say, that's the year I was born. This poem is called Cold by Robert Francis. Cold in the colors of cold, mineral, shell, and burning blue. The sky is on fire with blue, and wind keeps ringing the fire bell. I am caught up in a chill as high as creaking glaciers and powdered plume peaks and the absolutes of interstellar sky. Abstract, impersonal, metaphysical, pure, this dazzling art derides me. How should warm breath dare to exist, exult, endure? Hums in my ear the old erfather of freeze and burn, the pre-post Christian fellow before and after all myths and demonologies. Under the glaring and sardonic sun, behind the icicles in double glass, I huddle, hoard, hold out, hold on. We've run out of time for today's installation of poetry. All of the poems read today were found at poetryfoundation.org. That's poetryfoundation.org. Be sure to listen to poetry next month. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Larissa Biggers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Poetry is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you again for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service and this installation of poetry.